There was another impetus to emigration, perhaps the most insidious and long-lasting of all. Thousands of young Germans had been beguiled in recent decades by an American book that had enjoyed not only public acceptance, but also circulation among the knowing, who read it, savored it, dreamed about it, and discussed it with their friends. It was James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans, which extolled the frontier and gave a flashing, exciting portrait of life among the Indians. In a score of cities and 100 small towns, young men referred to themselves as Uncas or Leatherstocking, or especially Hawkeye. The Cooper novels evoked a powerful dream world. But letters from Germans who were actually living in Texas made that dream such an attractive possibility that thousands of young people in the little states sought to emigrate. When denied official permission, they formed a slow, clandestine movement of escape, peopled by those whose hope of a good life in Germany had been killed by repression and hunger. Quietly, without even informing their rulers or obtaining proper certification, they began drifting toward the port cities of Bremen and Hamburg, dozens at first, then hundreds, and finally thousands. It was this seepage of young men who might be needed to fill uniforms that infuriated the princes. And now the Margrave thundered, "You mentioned the Metzdorf I allowed to emigrate. Let me tell you, Allerkamp, the police are fully aware that he keeps sending seditious letters to someone here in Grenz, and they also know that the letters circulate, exciting people to go to Texas. The police keep a careful record of everyone who reads those letters, and they stand in the gateway to prison. And if you're not careful..." With this gratuitous advice, the Margrave dismissed his librarian, and when Ludwig left the castle, he carried with him the harsh realities of life in a German state, which he reviewed as he walked across the causeway over the moat. The Margrave cannot provide his men with homes or jobs, but he clings to them for manpower in case of war. How immoral! He was pondering this irony when he passed the bookshop of his neighbor Alois Metzdorf, and since they were in related businesses, he stuck his head in the door and asked, "What's the news?" Something in the way he did this, perhaps the obvious hesitancy of his stopping, alerted Metzdorf. "What's the matter, Ludwig?" And although Allerkamp was still in the street, he started to talk. With confidences he would never before have shared with the bookseller, he told of his disastrous meeting with the Margrave. And when he was through, Metzdorf said, "I have a letter you should read. It comes from my brother Hugo in Texas." And he pulled the bookbinder into his shop, while a policeman far up the street took note of this latest visitor. What an exciting letter! And when he passed it along, Allerkamp's hands almost trembled as he turned the flimsy pages covered with small, precise Gothic script, and his breathing almost stopped as he focused on particular paragraphs which arrested his attention. "No matter what they tell you, Alois, rattlesnakes leave an area which is well tended. I have not seen one in 6 months. And mosquitoes, which are so dreadful along the shore of the sea, do not molest us here. I assure you that there are a million wild horses to be caught and tamed if one has the patience, but we buy ours from Mexicans, who are superb at this skill. Melons, squash, beans, potatoes, cabbages of immense size, rutabagas, beets, celery, onions, radishes, peaches, pears, and corn, we have them all in abundance. Venison, beef, mutton, pork, we enjoy every week, but fish we do not have as yet. We do not bother with a church or the ministrations of a clergyman because we have such strong memories of their having been the agents of the Margrave back home. But we do go to the English minister for our marriages, which should always be entered into with God's blessing. In daily life, we are our own priests. Land is available in vast quantities, millions of unclaimed acres. It is waiting for you when you come. Night after night, we go to bed exhausted from hard, manly work. Bonnert, who was a poet in Grenzler, builds furniture, the best in this area. Hexter, who wanted to be a professor in Germany, is a farmer in Texas. Your friend Schmelzer, who trained to be an engineer, is a grower of sheep and cattle, and a good one. And I, who was to be a professor, am a farmer of more than 500 hectares. How the great wheel of the world changes in its revolutions. I will tell you one thing, old friend. Sometimes at night my heart breaks in longing for Grenz. The good food, the singing, the winter fires, prayer in the church. And if you join us, as I pray you will, your heart will break too in its hunger for the old ways, especially in December and January, when there is no snow on the ground. But there is a greater consolation. Here you will be free. No Margrave, no thundering minister, no conscripting officer from the regiment. You will be free, and Alois, that makes all the difference. Carefully, Allerkamp refolded the letter and handed it back to Metzdorf. Powerful statement. He certainly seems to be happy in Texas. Every letter he begs me to join him. I don't think Hugo would deceive me. Allerkamp reached out and tapped the letter. So you accept what he says? Metzdorf looked about his shop and whispered, "Every word. My brother would never deceive me." Ludwig nodded, for the two men wanted to believe that a refuge like Texas existed. "But," Allerkamp warned, "he says nothing reassuring about the Indians." "Ah," Metzdorf cried, "he said that in his last letter," and he produced an earlier, well-thumbed epistle in which Hugo had said explicitly, "I know you must be apprehensive about the Red Indians. They have long since left these parts, and I myself in all this time have seen only three or four who came here to trade. They were much like the Poles we saw that day in Grenz, different in speech, different in coloring and appearance, but ordinary men otherwise. I myself have traded with them and thought nothing of it." After studying this letter, Allerkamp started toward the door. Wildly excited by the visions of Texas, both epistles had reawakened. But before he could leave, Metzdorf said quietly, "I have this new book from Paris, and I want you to read it." And he took from a hiding place beneath his counter a small, unimpressive book which had been smuggled across many borders. Poems by Heinrich Heine, the Jewish exile. It was not a crime to have a book by this unpleasant man, but copies were confiscated when found, and persons who had read them were noted by the police. Allerkamp, like most Germans of his type, men who had been to university as had their fathers and grandfathers, adhered mainly to the great poetry of Goethe and Schiller, whom they revered, and few had any acquaintance with the renegade Heine. But they had heard rumors that he was an impassioned poet with much to say, so that they were naturally inquisitive as to his message. Also, the fact that he was Jewish lent his poetry an added aura of mystery, for such men knew few Jews and were alternately repelled by them and fascinated. Listen to what he says about us. "And when I reached St. Gotthard Pass, I could hear Germany snoring, asleep down below in the loving care of her 36 rulers." "Do the police know you have this book?" Allerkamp asked. "No, no, but I want you to read it. Heine has a lot to say to us." "Will you try to join your brother in America?" Metzdorf made no reply. He simply forced the book into his friend's hands and led him to the door. When Ludwig left the shop, he looked up and down the main street, but the policeman was gone. That evening, Ludwig Allerkamp assembled his family and said gravely, "Franziska, fetch the Bible." The quiet little girl, her two pigtails bobbing beside her ears, went to the bedroom, where she lifted the heavy brass-bound Bible and carried it to her father. He opened it to Psalms, from which he read regularly to his brood, and asked each member of the family to place a hand upon the sacred book. This was a curious, meaningful act, for in recent years he had grown increasingly impatient with the church, which sided always with the government and invariably against the interests of its parishioners. In fact, Ludwig Allerkamp, like most Germans who were contemplating emigration, had begun to drift away from the stern Lutheranism of his youth, for he found the church repressive and unresponsive. Yet still, in any moment of crisis, he turned instinctively to the Bible. Swear that you will repeat what we are about to say to no one, absolutely no one. Six right hands shared the open pages of Psalms. Six voices took the oath. The question before this meeting of the Allerkamp family, shall we, with or without permission, leave Germany and go to Texas? No one responded. Each member of the family visualized such evidence as she or he had heard, and each weighed the awful consequences of the decision to be made. Thekla, the mother, recalled the two earlier Metzdorf letters she had read, telling of life on the prairie. And all that she had heard reassured her that only in some such refuge could her four children find freedom. She was prepared to brave the dangers of the ocean crossing, the mosquitoes, and the rattlesnakes, if only she and her offspring could build good new lives. And all negative considerations were abolished, even her fear of Indians. Her eldest son, Theo, who so desperately wanted to marry, but who had been sentenced perhaps to perpetual bachelorhood by the stern laws of Germany, was eager to do anything to escape. He would emigrate tomorrow, and would say so when invited to speak. Brother Ernst, aged 18, had for some years imagined himself to be Uncas, striding through primeval forests, and was most eager to undertake such adventure. Brother Emil, 16, was prepared to go anywhere, and the more Indians, pirates, and gold-seekers en route, the better. That left Father Ludwig and Franziska, and their preferences were more tentative than those of their kinfolk. Ludwig loved Germany, and even though prevented from entering his chosen profession of teaching in some university, he felt a burning desire to stay and witness the unfolding of German history. He felt his homeland to be on the verge of great accomplishments, perhaps a unification of the 100 petty states, perhaps a release from the strictures of Metternich's oppression, perhaps a bursting forth of the German spirit into brave new worlds of industrial expansion and revitalized universities. He was extremely optimistic where Germany was concerned, and foresaw the gradual disappearance of anachronisms like the old Margrave. But he was also cruelly aware that his family must somehow survive the period of transition, and he saw no likelihood of accomplishing this under current circumstances. His persistent fear was that Germany would engage in a revolution which would accomplish nothing, but which would surely engulf his three sons, for they were lads of strong opinion and firm character, not likely to remain aloof from such vibrant movement. Hugo Metzdorf's most recent letter from Texas strengthened his resolve to seek refuge there immediately. Up to now, Franziska had rarely participated in family discussions of any gravity, for she was a carefully nurtured girl who had been taught to sit properly, never intrude on a conversation, and respect the instructions of anyone older than herself. But she had a most lively imagination and a sharp perception of what was occurring about her, and her family would have been surprised at the accuracy with which she assessed their motives and anticipated their actions. Encouraged by her brother Ernst, who wanted to roam with Uncas, she had read The Last of the Mohicans and seen pretty quickly that it was largely romantic nonsense. Also, several reports in the German press, inspired by rulers who were determined to keep their subjects at home, had told of great dust storms, hurricanes, Indian attacks, and the prevalence of rattlesnakes in Texas. Unlike her brothers, she had read books sponsored by the rulers and written by Germans who had emigrated to Texas, only to return home on the first available ship. Texas is a dreadful place. The food is inedible. The houses have no windows. Paved floors do not exist. A strange disease they call El Vomito kills people within a week of landing. Indians and rattlesnakes prowl behind the barn, if a man is lucky enough to have a barn. Do not come to Texas. I tried it and lasted only 1 week. How passionately I kissed the deck of the good German vessel that carried me back to Bremen. She was, therefore, not at all eager to leap into such an adventure. But when she remembered how her brother Theo had sagged when the Margrave said, "You may not marry," she could look ahead to the mournful day when it was she standing before the ruler, seeking permission to marry some young man of Grentz, only to hear the harsh words, "You may not." And she knew that her only salvation was emigration to some free land like Texas. She also recalled how her plea for an education had been denied, and she became angry. "We should go." And when her small voice uttered these words, a flood of comment was loosened, and the Allerkamp family, aware of all the terrors, mental and physical, which threatened, decided that as soon as the opportunity presented itself, they would quietly slip away from the beloved Margravate of Grenzler, with or without legal permission, and make their way through whatever dangers to the wharf at Bremen, where they would offer themselves as emigrants to a better land. When the unanimous decision was reached, Ludwig asked them to place their hands on the Bible again. "On our solemn oath, we speak to no one." And when this was agreed, he told his children, "I want you to study these poems of Heine again. He's a Jew, and his work is outlawed, but he speaks like a golden trumpet." And before passing along the book, he read from it. "Time passes on, but that chateau, that old chateau with its high steeple, it never fades out of my mind, filled as it was with stupid people." That's what we're exchanging, the stupid chateau for the free forest. "Will you be a bookbinder there?" Franziska asked, and her father said, "No, they'll have no need of bookbinders in the forest." "What will you do?" the girl asked. And before her father could respond, Ernst Uncas cried, "He'll shoot deer and make moccasins." "We'll certainly have a farm," Ludwig said, "but I'll find other work too." "What kind of work?" Franziska asked, and he replied, "We'll have to see." They all agreed later. It was a miracle, and in a way it was a twofold miracle, because the very next day a wanderer from the north came to town and passed along the main street, stopping everyone and asking, "Do you wish to buy paper which entitles you to free land in Texas?" In various ways, a large supply of scrip issued by the Republic of Texas had found its way to Germany, and each certificate entitled the purchaser to acres of land without further payment. Half the paper for sale consisted of legal documents circulated by Toby and Brother of New Orleans to encourage immigration. And this carried certain complexities regarding surveying and court procedures. But the other half were bounty warrants issued to veterans of the war, and this gave immediate title to 320 acres, provided only that an official surveyor could be found to identify and map the land chosen. It was supposed that the surveyor would receive for his services one-third of the land so identified, unless the holder of the scrip wished to pay a fee in cash. Ludwig Allerkamp, a cautious man, suspected chicanery in such an offering, and would have nothing to do with the paper, regardless of which form it took. Some did buy, however, for modest sums. And it was here that the second miracle occurred, because the mayor of the town bought 6 certificates, 4 Toby, 2 soldier bounties, for a modest sum, only to find that the police were taking down the names of all holders. "Nothing illegal, Mayor, but the Margrave wants to know who's been dabbling with the idea of emigration." "Not me," the mayor lied. "I have no papers of any kind." And to make this assurance viable, he quickly hurried to the bookshop of Alois Metzdorf, known to be an agitator, to whom he confided in a jumble of whispers, "These papers, the police inspectors, in my position as mayor, you know there's nothing wrong, you understand, but in my responsible position as mayor, here, you take them, they can do you no harm." As soon as the mayor left, Metzdorf slipped out the back door and ran through alleys to the home of Allerkamp. "Ludwig, it's providential. I know you want to go to Texas, and someone I can't name just gave me 6 certificates for land there. I can't emigrate yet, but..." The conspirators stood silent, and slowly Metzdorf pushed the sacred papers into his friend's hands. No one spoke. And then, in a rush of gratitude, Alarcamp embraced his friend. "Alois, I'll hold the best fields for you till you come." In this way, the lands of Axel Wexter, veteran of San Jacinto, found an owner. To help the Alarcamps make decisions, Alois Metzdorf loaned them A Practical Guide to a Wealthy Life in America, in which 16 German families advised newcomers as to how they could strike their fortune in the New World. It advised travelers as to what they must take for areas such as Pennsylvania, the most hospitable of the states and the most like Germany, Missouri, the state with the most attractive free land and the greatest opportunity for getting rich, and Texas, the most exciting land, an independent nation now but likely to become a part of the United States. "We shall need tools and medicines and all the clothes we can carry," Ludwig said after studying the recommendations. "Books?" Thekla asked. And here her husband had to make painful choices. "Our Bible, Goethe, Schiller, the book on agriculture." By curious choice, upon which the family would often comment in later years, he added, "It'll be a practical land. I'll take along my two mathematics books." These would prove to be more useful ultimately than all the others. But it would be the books of poetry that would echo most strongly and persistently, for they represented the soul of the Germany they were leaving. When the secret packing was completed and hidden away so that guests could not see, the Alarcamps invited into their home for the last time the members of a singing group with whom they had known so much enjoyment. And when the various families gathered that last Sunday afternoon, the four strong-voiced Alarcamp men led the others in songs that had echoed through the town of Grenz for centuries. Ludwig had a strong baritone, and Theo had a clear, ringing, high-voiced tenor, with the two younger boys filling in nicely. Others of the group had fine voices, too, and the air was rich with music. But Franziska saw that as her mother played the accompaniments, tears filled her eyes, and the child knew that she was saying farewell to this splendid piano over which both mother and daughter had studied so diligently. No more would this instrument guide them in song, and the realization that a glorious part of her life was ending was almost too painful to bear. They sang until midnight, and in some mysterious way, without a word having been spoken, it became apparent to many of the older people that a requiem was being sung. Some profound change was underway. Someone was departing. Some new force was arriving. Some secret aspect of Germany was being modified. But if certain canny men suspected what Alarcamp was up to, they did not reveal it. Accepting what money they could get from a surreptitious sale of their possessions, they slipped out of town before dawn one Wednesday morning and slowly made their way toward the port of Bremerhaven, negotiating one passport and customs barrier after another. They moved from one petty kingdom to the next, where the rulers of each tried to prevent the entry of refugees from other principalities, lest they become squatters and a financial drain. But Ludwig, by means of cajolery, lies, and even small bribes, maneuvered his caravan across half of Germany, coming at last to the busy city of Bremen, some distance from the harbor from which the ships sailed. Here he reported to the offices of the Atlantic and Caribbean lines, which owned two sailing vessels plying to Texas, the Poseidon and the Sea Nymph. Captain Longbein, in command of the latter, assured the Alarcamps that they had chosen wisely, and that he would personally oversee their pleasant trip across the Atlantic. Since his ship would not be departing for 9 days, he directed the family to lodgings utilized by his firm, and then extended them the courtesy of his home, where Frau Longbein proved to be a gracious, motherly lady and a superb cook. "The captain wants me to serve you the best food," she explained, "so that you'll get homesick and sail back to Germany some day with him. That way he earns double fares." She said that she had sailed once with him to Galveston. "I was seasick, but it passes quickly," I loved the voyage, and would go tomorrow if he'd allow me. As guests of the Langbeins, the Allerkamps attended two operas in Bremen, Mozart's Figaro's Hochzeit and Weber's Du Freischütz, and the emigrants showed such appreciation of the robust singing that Captain Langbein volunteered advice. Take plenty of music with you. It tames the wilderness. We'll have no piano, Fekla explained, but he was insistent. There will be many pianos in Texas. You will find one, and then you'll be sorry you didn't bring music for it. This posed a problem, for the family had only the most meager funds, with not a pfennig to spare for luxuries. But as they prowled the back streets seeking bargains, Fekla came upon used scores of Beethoven and Schubert and a collection of Mozart piano sonatas, and they were so reasonable that she cried, I cannot cross the ocean without them. But when Ludwig approached the owner, even the reduced price was forbidding, and he was about to lead his family from the shop, when to his amazement Franziska intruded, Sir, we are sailing to a far land, and we must have the music. The man stooped till his face was level with hers and asked, But can you play Mozart? And she went stiffly to a piano, adjusted the stool, and began to play with youthful skill the Mozart sonata in C major, known as the Easy Sonata, with such grace that he cried, Buy the Beethoven and Schubert, and I'll give your little princess the Mozart. Next day, the Allerkamps sailed for Texas. It was not till the rickety, swaying sea-nymph reached mid-ocean that Franziska Allerkamp felt well enough to make her first entry in the diary she had acquired in Bremerhaven. Monday, the 31st of October. This ship is a leaky tub. It is tossed about by every wave. There's not enough water, and the food is horrible. To save his leaky ship, Captain Langbein had all men passengers operate the pumps 24 hours a day. I have thrown up so much that I can no longer be sick. How pitiful man is upon an ocean like this! Despite the inconveniences of shipboard life, Franziska found ways to care for her appearance, combing and braiding her hair each morning, and doing everything possible to present the picture of a well-bred German lass. Her neatness was remarked by many, and several older women, when they were well enough to move about, congratulated Thekla on her daughter's cleanliness. And charm, too. She's a fine child. Since Franziska secretly coveted such approbation, she took extra pains, and inevitably some of the young men began to pay attention. But her mother, obsessed with creating in Franziska a model German girl who could sew, play the piano, cook, and observe what Thekla called the niceties, quickly disciplined the would-be suitors. No, she cannot sing with you, and she certainly can't walk the lower decks either. Wednesday, the 9th of November. Grandmother taught me always to be neat, and grandfather warned me many times, You must smile at young men to show them respect and make them feel important, but you must never flirt. I don't think I would care to marry before 21, because the village girls who did so and who then came into Grenz were never happy. I could tell from looking at their long faces that they yearned to join our dances in the town square, but with babes at the knee they could not. Obedient to her mother's standards, she had stopped being a young girl and had already become a poised little woman. As she moved about the upper decks, she avoided conversation, preferring to listen to others. But on the rare occasions when she did speak, she could be quite firm. Sometimes, when she eavesdropped, which was not very ladylike, she picked up bits of information that confused her. Saturday, the 10th of December. Father and mother did not think I was listening, but I heard the elders discussing Captain Langbein, whom I like very much. A man who lives in Texas but had business in Germany told them that Captain Langbein has a wife in Texas, as well as the one in Bremen, whom I met and liked so much. I am worried about this, and would like to ask Mother whether it could be true, for if it is, Captain Langbein must be a very bad man, which I find hard to believe. 2 days later, as they were approaching Cuba, A storm more violent than any they had known in the European seas overtook them from the east, throwing their pitiful craft about as if it were a cork adrift in a whirlpool. Nearly everyone was wretchedly sick, and often too weak to stagger from the cabins. But Franziska, one of the few able to stand, volunteered to clean up the smelly messes. She had no inclination to feel sorry for herself, because Captain Langbein, in obvious distress, called for all men to return to the pumps. And for three perilous days, the 21st of December through the night of the 23rd of December, she knew that all four of her family's menfolk were toiling in the bowels of the ship, straining at the powerful German pumps, but almost to no avail, for an incredible amount of water continued to stream in through the many cracks. And toward midnight on the 23rd, Ludwig staggered topside to speak with his wife. "Fekla, if anything happens, look first for Franziska. The boys and I will have done all we could." At about 4 that morning, the frail ship plowed headlong into a huge series of waves, which swept a sailor and two passengers overboard. Their screams were heard briefly, then only the howling of the terrible wind. Fekla, in the cabin, was sure the ship must come apart under the dreadful strain, and so did her husband at the pumps. But these towering breakers marked the end of the violence, and by sunrise on the 24th of December, the Caribbean had begun to subside, so that when Christmas Eve approached, a weak sun actually appeared through the clouds. Sunday, the 25th of December, 1842. We had a quiet Christmas. Father took me down into the ship, and when I saw the holes through which the sea came at us, I wondered why we did not sink. I was not afraid during the storm, because I kept busy helping the women with children, but tonight I am terribly afraid. I know this ship cannot last much longer, and I think Father knows it too. And, from the look on Captain Langbein's face, he knows it better than any of us. I no longer care if he has two wives. He was very brave during the storm, always taking the wheel when the waves were worst. When I marry, I would want my husband to be much like Captain Langbein, but I would not be happy if he took another wife, too. When the limping sea nymph, her backbone almost shattered by the storms, staggered into Matagorda Bay, all hands cheered. But the sudden onset of a howling wind from across the bay prevented them from landing that day. Monday, the 2nd of January, 1843. After breakfast this morning, we finally landed, and it was lucky that we did, for although we got quite dampened by the heavy spray, no great damage was done. But when almost everyone was ashore, and I was looking inland to see our new home, one of the young men who had been nice to me cried in a loud voice, "Jesus Christ!" And all of us turned to look back at the sea, where our sea nymph rolled quietly over and sank. Captain Langbein swam ashore, and when he joined us he said, "For the past 2 weeks I thought we'd probably sink." And I asked him what others were afraid to ask. "Did you think so during the bad storm?" And he said, "I expected to go down any minute, little girl." This afternoon some of the women told Mother, "The sinking of that ship was God's curse on the captain for having two wives." And I thought about this for a long time. Suppose the ship had sunk 6 days ago with all of us passengers lost. Would that still have been God's way to punish one immoral captain? What about us? I think the ship sank because the company took too great a risk in sending out such a rotten crate. When the six Allerkamps stood with their luggage on the shore of Matagorda Bay, they had no specific idea of where they would sleep that night, or where they would travel in the days ahead, or where they would locate the land on which they would build their permanent home. If ever the word immigrant meant one who comes into a new country, it applied to the members of this family. A man who built handcarts with solid wooden wheels approached Ludwig. "You'll have to have one. $3. Have you ever heard of Hugo Metzdorf?" "All the Germans have. You can trust him. Lives at a place called Hard Work." And in the sand, the wagon builder showed them in general how to find their way first to Victoria, 40 miles to the west, and from there to hard work, 90 miles to the north. "Everyone," Ludwig cried, assembling his family and pointing to the sand, "memorize this map." And with no aid but that, the Allerkamps loaded their handcart, tied a rope to the front, put Theo at the handles, and set out, with Ludwig hauling on the rope and leading the way. It was simpler than it sounded, because even in the earlier days when Otto McNab and his father traversed this route, there was a kind of path to Victoria. Now it was a dusty road. From there, another rough-and-ready trail led north, so there was little chance of getting lost. But to walk 130 miles with a handcart and sleep on the bare ground in January was not easy. However, in due course, the pilgrims reached a slight rise, and there they looked down upon a sight that warmed them. It was a replica of a German village, complete with rough stone houses, a central square, and prosperous fields that stretched out to thick woodland. "It was worth it," Ludwig cried as he started down the slope. And Franziska asked, "Is this where we'll take our land?" And her father said, "We'll find even better." Until they located the land they wanted, they would stop temporarily at hard work. But they were surprised to find that earlier German arrivals already owned the locations in town, and that in the surrounding countryside, for many miles in every direction, the attractive rolling land was also taken. "I thought," Theo said, "that everything was free." It wasn't. Hugo Metzdorf, the acknowledged leader of the community, explained that there were millions of acres to which the Allerkamp certificates could be applied, but they were always out there, meaning to the west. The newcomers were assured, however, that their papers were authentic. None better than these four sold by Toby and brother in New Orleans. And, of course, your two military ones are best of all. Metzdorf, who had done a good deal of land selection, ticked off the situation, indicating each paper as he did. And in the end, he whistled, 3,000 acres in all. You must have paid a pretty pfennig for these. When Ludwig nodded, Hugo asked, You bring much money with you? No? Well, neither did any of us. He flexed his right arm. That's what does it in Texas. He advised the Allerkamps to spend their first 2 years in hard work. Fine German woman here lost her husband a year ago. She'll rent you a room. Later on, build yourself a shack, not a house like mine. Then look around you, visit other towns, get yourself a horse and ride west, and wherever you go, study the land. What do we do when we find it? Now you have to have some money, because you must get a surveyor. He lines it out proper and files his papers with the government, and then you get title. But you have to pay the surveyor. If we have no money? Customary rate, he takes 1/3 of the land. When Ludwig whistled, Metzdorf said, I know it sounds high, in your case 1,000 acres, and at 8 cents an acre that's $80 American. And who in Texas has $80? The widowed woman was actually eager to have the Allerkamps share her half-empty house and to sell them a small plot of land. And in a shorter time than even Metzdorf, an energetic man, could have anticipated, they were at work, building not a shack, as he had prudently advised, but a real house, a kitchen and alcoves for beds. And in doing so, they repeated the heroic steps by which all parts of Texas would be settled. Sunrise to sunset, work. Sunday, prayers. Clothes and furniture made by hand. Fields cleared by chopping and plowed by foot shovels. Food, an endless repetition of cornbread, bacon, and coffee. But when a family had 2 energetic elders and 4 stalwart young people, the outcome was apt to be startling. And in the case of the Allerkamps, it was doubly so. By the end of the 2nd month, they had the corner posts of their home in place, and all members of the family were learning English from a book they had purchased in Bremen. Much sooner than they expected, they were brought into full citizenship. For in early March, a man came to their house, riding one horse and leading another. He was a smallish fellow, and he brought a surprising invitation. Name's Otto McNab, Texas Ranger. trouble along the Nueces River, and Captain Garner of this county would like to have one of your boys join him in an expedition. Is it that we are obliged to? Ludwig asked on behalf of his three sons. Not an order, but if you're going to live in Texas, we have only the guns we need for food, no horse. Captain Garner figured that. He sends this horse. Guns? He slapped the space behind his saddle, and the Ollerkamp saw three rifles plus the two pistols protruding from Otto's belt. Can you speak the truth? The father asked. And before he could continue, Otto said, No, you don't have to come, but this is how we protect places like yours. Against maybe who? Mexicans? Indians? As soon as he heard the word Indians, Ernst Ollerkamp, the middle boy, reared on James Fenimore Cooper, stepped forward. I will go, and it was agreed. When Otto turned to untie the trailing horse and hand over one of the guns, he became aware of a girl hiding in the shadows, and his eyes wandered from the men and focused on her. She was a small girl, 14 or 15, with flaxen braids, and a shyness which manifested itself in the curious way she stood, half withdrawn from the scene, half participating. He could not bring his eyes back to the men, and paid little attention to what they were saying about the Indian War. He was riveted by the girl, and drank in every aspect of her attractive appearance, her white stockings, her homemade shoes, her dress with that flowery bit about the hem, her belt encompassing her narrow waist, the way her blouse was beginning to protrude, but most of all, her placid face framed by the two braids of golden hair. It was an image emerging from shadows that would live with him forever. For her part, the girl saw a young man not much older than herself, tow-headed, blue-eyed, clean-faced, pistols in his belt, homespun clothes and very dusty, heavy leather boots square as a box, never a smile, leading a horse by a bridle that hung carelessly from his left arm. A young man who spoke in a low voice, and who stared at her as if he had never seen a girl before. From her place in the shadows, she could imagine him astride his horse, riding through rolling woodlands that seemed to stretch endlessly west and south. He was capable, of that she felt sure, and she supposed that he could use his pistols and the rifles that projected from his saddlebag. He was the new man, the man of Texas, and she was fascinated by him. But, as a well-bred daughter of a conservative German family, she kept to the shadows. Neither the young man nor the girl smiled during that first meeting, nor did they speak, nor did they reveal by any gesture other than those endless glances the impression that each had made on the other. But all during his 3-month fight in the Nueces Strip, the man could think of little else when he rode silently or slept fitfully. And during those same long days, the girl saw horsemen galloping across battlefields or resting beside rivers or splashing through fords. And invariably, this quiet young fellow with the blue eyes and sand-colored hair was in the lead.